Chapter 60. To possess special features of interest for his eyes. Nobody can hurt a dead woman, at length said Coggan, with the precision of a machine. All that could be done for her is done. She's beyond us. And why should a man put himself in a tearing hurry for lifeless clay, that can neither feel nor see, and don't know what you do with her at all? If she'd been alive, I would have been the first to help her. If she now wanted victuals and drink, I'd pay for it, money down. But she's dead, and no speed of ours will bring her to life. The woman's past us, time spent upon her is thrown away. Why should we hurry to do what's not required? Drink, shepherd, and be friends, for tomorrow we may be like her. We may, added Mark Clark, emphatically, at once drinking himself, to run no further risk of losing his chance by the event alluded to, Jan meanwhile merging his additional thoughts of tomorrow in a song. Tomorrow, tomorrow. And while peace and plenty I find at my board, with a heart free from sickness and sorrow, with my friends, will I share what today may afford, and let them spread the tabli tomorrow. Tomorrow, tomorrow do hold thy horning, Jan, said Oak, and turning upon poor grass, as for you, Joseph, who do your wicked deeds in such confoundedly holy ways, you are as drunk as you can stand. No, Shepherd Oak, no. Listen to reason, Shepherd. All that's the matter with me is the affliction called a multiplying eye, and that's how it is I look double to you. I mean, you look double to me. A multiplying eye is a very bad thing, said Mark Clark. It always comes on when I have been in a public house a little time, said Joseph Poorgrass, meekly. Yes, I see two of every sort, as if I were some holy man living in the times of King Noah and entering into the ark. Why, yes, he added, becoming much affected by the picture of himself as a person thrown away, and shedding tears. I feel too good for England. I ought to have lived in Genesis by rights, like the other men of sacrifice, and then I shouldn't have been called a DD drunkard in such a way. I wish you'd show yourself a man of spirit, and not sit whining there. Show myself a man of spirit? Well, let me take the name of drunkard humbly. I it me be a man of contrite knees. I it be, I'll know that I always do say least God afore I do anything, from my getting up to my going down of the same, and I be willing to take as much disgrace as there is in that holy act. Ha, yes, but not a man of spirit? Have I ever allowed the toe of pride to be lifted against my hinder parts without groaning manfully, that I question the right to do so? I inquire that query boldly. We can't say that you have, Hero Poorgrass, admitted January. Never have I allowed such treatment to pass unquestioned. Yet the shepherd says in the face of that rich testimony, that I be not a man of spirit. Well, let it pass by, and death is a kind friend. Gabriel, seeing that neither of the three was in a fit state to take charge of the wagon for the remainder of the journey, made no reply, but, closing the door again upon them, went across to where the vehicle stood, now getting indistinct in the fog and gloom of this mildewy time. He pulled the horse's head from the large patch of turf it had eaten bare, readjusted the boughs over the coffin, and drove along through the unwholesome night. It had gradually become rumored in the village that the body to be brought and buried that day was all that was left of the unfortunate Fanny Robin who had followed the 11th from Casterbridge through Melchester and onwards. But, thanks to Boldwood's reticence and Oak's generosity, the loveress he had followed had never been individualized as Troy. Gabriel hoped that the whole truth of the matter might not be published till at any rate the girl had been in her grave for a few days, when the interposing barriers of earth and time, and a sense that the events had been somewhat shut into oblivion, would deaden the sting that revelation and invidious remark would have for Bathsheba just now. By the time that Gabriel reached the old manor house, her residence, which lay in his way to the church, it was quite dark. A man came from the gate and said through the fog, which hung between them like lone flowers, that Poorgrass with the corpse. Gabriel recognized the voice as that of the parson. "The corpse is here, sir," said Gabriel. "I have just been to inquire of Mrs. Troy, if she could tell me the reason of the delay. I am afraid it is too late now for the funeral to be performed with proper decency. Have you the registrar's certificate?"
"No,"
said Gabriel. "I expect Poorgrass has that, and he's at the Buck's Head. I forgot to ask him for it." "Then that settles the matter. We'll put off the funeral till tomorrow morning. The body may be brought onto the church, or it may be left here at the farm and fetched by the bearers in the morning." They waited more than an hour, and have now gone home. Gabriel had his reasons for thinking the latter a most objectionable plan, notwithstanding that Fanny had been an inmate of the farmhouse for several years in the lifetime of Bathsheba's uncle. Visions of several unhappy contingencies which might arise from this delay flitted before him. But his will was not law, and he went indoors to inquire of his mistress what were her wishes on the subject. He found her in an unusual mood. Her eyes as she looked up to him were suspicious and perplexed, as with some antecedent thought. Troy had not yet returned. At first Bathsheba assented with a mien of indifference to his proposition that they should go on to the church at once with their burden, but immediately afterwards, following Gabriel to the gate, she swerved to the extreme of solicitousness on Fanny's account and desired that the girl might be brought into the house. Oak argued upon the convenience of leaving her in the wagon, just as she lay now, with her flowers and green leaves about her, merely wheeling the vehicle into the coach house till the morning, but to no purpose. "It is unkind and unchristian," she said, "to leave the poor thing in a coach house all night." "Very well, then," said the parson, "and I will arrange that the funeral shall take place early tomorrow. Perhaps Mrs. Troy is right in feeling that we cannot treat a dead fellow creature too thoughtfully. We must remember that, though she may have erred grievously in leaving her home, she is still our sister, and it is to be believed that God's uncovenanted mercies are extended towards her, and that she is a member of the flock of Christ." The parson's words spread into the heavy air with a sad yet unperturbed cadence, and Gabriel shed an honest tear. Bathsheba seemed unmoved. Mr. Thirdly then left them, and Gabriel lighted a lantern. Fetching three other men to assist him, they bore the unconscious truant indoors, placing the coffin on two benches in the middle of a little sitting room next the hall, as Bathsheba directed. Everyone except Gabriel Oak then left the room. He still indecisively lingered beside the body. He was deeply troubled at the wretchedly ironical aspect that circumstances were putting on with regard to Troy's wife, and at his own powerlessness to counteract them. In spite of his careful maneuvering all this day, the very worst event that could in any way have happened in connection with the burial had happened now. Oak imagined a terrible discovery resulting from this afternoon's work that might cast over Bathsheba's life a shade which the interposition of many lapsing years might but indifferently lighten, and which nothing at all might altogether remove. Suddenly, as in a last attempt to save Bathsheba from, at any rate, immediate anguish, he looked again, as he had looked before, at the chalk writing upon the coffin lid. The scrawl was this simple one: "Fanny Robin and Child." Gabriel took his handkerchief and carefully rubbed out the two latter words, leaving visible the inscription "Annie Robin only." He then left the room and went out quietly by the front door. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.